This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Granderson running hard. He's heading to third. They're going to wave him home. Here he comes. He's going to be safe.
Granderson is back at the track, at the wall, leaping, and he made that catch.
He's gone. A two-run homer for Curtis Granderson. Welcome home, Grandy.
Curtis Granderson has put together an impressive resume in his 16 seasons in Major League Baseball. He started his career with the Detroit Tigers and played on seven teams and in two World Series. But if it wasn't for the support of his community, he might never have made it this far. Here's reporter Olivia Christian.
Soon after getting the call up in 2004, Curtis Granderson got to play in his hometown, Chicago. And on day three of that series, he recorded his first major league hit, much to the elation of some special fans who came to see his debut.
I get the hit, they announce my name, the little section of 60 people are cheering. And then the Chicago White Sox to this day, and I'm very thankful for it, they put it up on the board. First major league hit for Curtis Granderson. And usually don't do that for the visiting team,
yeah.
But they did that for me, so that was really cool.
It's memories like that one, moments that involve family, childhood friends, and his hometown that helped shape Granderson into the man that he is today and keep the 16-year veteran grounded and grateful. Granderson first found the game because he couldn't find his friends.
All the friends in my neighborhood, we would go to the pool together, ride our bikes together, do this together. And one day, nobody was there. Where'd everyone go? And my mom goes, they all went and signed up for baseball. Well, I don't want to be left out. So I went and signed up for baseball, too. And that's how it all started.
Granderson remembers that the teams in his T-ball league were all named after NHL franchises. His was the Sabres.
We had green T-shirts. And my mom didn't buy baseball pants. I had jeans. Those were my baseball pants. And we all rotated positions. Yeah, you were this position one inning, you were that position the next inning. I have no idea if we won games or lost games, what place we were in. So I don't know if we were good or bad, but I just remember it was a lot of fun.
As a 90s kid growing up in the suburbs of Chicago during the Bulls dynasty, Granderson had hoop dreams.
You know, who didn't want to be like Mike? I remember having the 6 foot tall Jordan poster that I put on my back of my door. Then you had the little basketball hoop, the Jordan jammer. But even though that was happening, the Cubs were on every day after school. The White Sox were there. It was always Little League Day, Kid Day, Teacher Day, Something Day. So I went to a lot of White Sox games. Very affordable. That was cool, and I wanted to be like those guys. You know, Bo Jackson played for the White Sox, Harold Baines, Ozzie Guillen, Robin Ventura, you know, Frank Thomas, all guys that were some really good guys to watch and want to be like, some Hall of Famers in there.
Granderson found even more players to emulate when he was assigned a book report in elementary school.
So I remember going to the library and I wanted to do a baseball book, so I'm picking this. And then I see Jackie Robinson, I see the Negro Leagues. The first thing that stood out to me was how they wore their uniforms. I was like, man, that looks way better than the jeans I'm wearing out on the field, right? You know, I want to look like that.
As Granderson got older, his uniforms looked more and more like the players he admired. And he started caring about wins and losses. But he wasn't the guy everyone was talking about.
There was times I just remember hearing about this kid was the top kid. You know, he was selected for the All-Star team first. Everybody wanted to see what that kid would do in high school. So I was always playing catch up. The fact that I was never that guy gave me room and somebody to look forward and hunt down.
Steadily, he did just that. Granderson was called up to the varsity team as a sophomore.
Our teams were very good in high school. We had a lot of fun. I remember junior, senior, 98, 99, and No Limit Records was huge. Master P and Silk the Shock, a Mystical, Miax, all that, and Bout It Bout It came out.
You bout it, I'm bout it, bout it. If you bout it, bout it, we'll say you bout it, bout it.
And we would get out on the field before the game, and our school was TF South, Thornton Fractional South. So we'd say, TFS is bout it, bout it.
Granderson stayed bout it through high school and received recruiting letters from colleges from all over the country. He chose the University of Illinois at Chicago. He played through his junior year and then started in the minors while juggling his schoolwork. In 2002, Granderson was playing in the Florida State League in hot, humid, rainy conditions, and in 10,000-seat stadiums that only managed to attract 200 to 300 fans. He thought seriously about quitting the game.
And I just was like, man, all my friends are at home going to this concert, going to this beach, going to this barbecue. What are you doing for the 4th of July? I have a game. Well, we're at this party. And you know how it is. You call with everybody in the background. You can hear all the noise going on. You can see some fireworks. Well, they're supposed to do fireworks after the game, but I'm going to be in the locker room. You get in barbecue. They're supposed to bring down food from the concession stand. So hopefully if they didn't sell it all, I can get a burger, right? All this is going on. I'm just like, man, this isn't, I don't know if this is it.
One night, Granderson got on the phone with Joe, a friend since fourth grade.
You know, him and I are chatting. We had free nights and weekends back then. We just chatted about non-baseball stuff, stuff that we would back home. And we're just talking.
Those feelings of doubt and loneliness began to subside, and Granderson found joy in playing the game again. He went on to get his college degree. In 2004, he had just finished his season with a Class AA Erie Seawolves.
After every season, I would just take my glove, toss it away, and my cleats, because they'd been worn out, used up, right? I'm going to use new ones next year. I get called into the office, and they go, you're going to Detroit. I was like, what? So I got to go back to the garbage can, pull my glove out, pull my cleats out, and then get to Detroit the next day, and wow, I'm in the major leagues. And this is something cool about my family. Everyone's like, oh, did your family come out? It's like, no. They're like, you're coming to Chicago in 2 weeks. We'll wait and see you then. Now, I'm in Detroit. Detroit and Chicago is only 3.5-hour ride away. I make it to Chicago. I play the first game. My dad's in a softball league. He goes, I got a softball game tomorrow. So he doesn't show for the second game. Dimitri Young is a teammate of mine with the Tigers. Goes, your dad's not here? Goes, man, he had a softball game. He goes, that's why I love your parents, man. They know where their priorities are. They're like, we'll see you later, son. And that's just how it was. And I think that helped me too. Like, I was never better than anybody. And it's been so helpful. They never put too much pressure on me.
Granderson earned a reputation of being a genuine guy in the clubhouse and someone who really cared about his hometown. And when he was asked how he planned to use his platform, what cause he would focus on, for him it was a no-brainer: education and fitness. That's why he brings kids to college campuses to play baseball.
We have kids that live walking distance from a college school and have never been on a college campus before. So now when it's time for them to practice, this is what college looks like. You know what? No one in my family's ever gone, this thing is kind of cool. Maybe I might want to do this, right? You know, Chicago's one of the most segregated cities in the U.S., and it's, you can call it a good or a bad thing, however you want to look at it. But because of that, some people never leave their neighborhood. 2017, I had a kid, 10 years old, a black kid, come to me and go, hey, coach, that's my first white person I've seen in real life. This is 2017. So these are problems that we're facing in Chicago and all over the U.S., and these are the things that I'm trying to help and hopefully move in the right direction. You're not going to fix it today, but you're going to hopefully move it in the right direction.
Granderson has quietly crafted a career of staying about it, both on the field and off. The three-time All-Star, three-time Marvin Miller Man of the Year, winner of the Silver Slugger and Roberto Clemente Awards, recently made the top 100 all-time home run list. He now has 343. His Twitter and Instagram feeds aren't filled with boast posts. He publicizes nonprofit partnerships, team wins, the kids that participate in his Grandkids Foundation. Not his every thought or every meal.
Unless it's something really good, you know, then I put it out there. So that's just been me.
This season, Granderson brought that attitude to the Miami Marlins. As a veteran in the clubhouse, he's got stories to share, from playing in the World Series to not overthinking it. He even writes on the bill of his cap, don't think, just play. Just how long he'll continue to do it all is still a question.
People go, you started playing when? Like my teammates, because we got a very young team here. I go, yeah, I've been playing for a while. I didn't realize it. I think I'm still 23, you know? I was just in school. I graduated. I've been to the World Series, all these different things. Now it's starting to kind of hit me. I'm the oldest guy on this team. I've never had that happen. Here, I'm that guy now. So I want to see these guys go on and do amazing, get them a World Series, make All-Star games, end up in the record books, destroy everything that I've ever done.
He wouldn't tell me when he plans to retire, but Granderson says he knows he's not going to hit the 20-year career mark.
I'm getting closer to that final curve, just the way the game is going. I never thought I'd play this long, so whenever the day happens to be done, I'm excited for what comes next.
And we'll all have to pay close attention to when that day arrives, because he'll likely leave the game just as he played, quietly.
That's reporter Olivia Christian. If you enjoy hearing stories like this one from athletes you admire, please leave us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe to our podcast. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Just a few years after his professional baseball career ended, Pete Murphy found himself working in the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001.
The building moved so much that I actually stumbled and I had to grab onto the cubicle wall.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Think of NPR's Life Kit as that friend who always has great advice on everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. We bring you tools to help you get it together. Listen and subscribe to NPR's Life Kit All Guides to get all of our episodes on every topic all in one place.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for 3 stories you should know.
Call God. In the time of crisis, all I ask is love.
That's newly signed Patriots wide receiver Antonio Brown in an Instagram live post from Thursday night, just 2 days after he was accused of rape in a federal lawsuit.
The devil gonna try to bring you down when you get closer to your goals.
And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Bleacher Report's Miren Fader and by 538's Chris Herring. Welcome back to both of you.
Hey, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to start by talking about Antonio Brown, and believe me, I'd rather not. I'd rather not be put in the position to talk about another NFL athlete who's accused of doing something awful to a woman. This week, Antonio Brown was accused of assaulting his former personal trainer in a civil lawsuit. His lawyers immediately claimed that the relationship was consensual. And I really don't know who's telling the truth, but I have read the text messages allegedly sent by Brown to the woman he claims he was in a consensual relationship with. And they're vile. And I feel like we're in a loop here. Antonio Brown says he didn't rape her, but there are the text messages. Tyreek Hill says he didn't physically harm the mother of his child, but he was caught on tape threatening her. And there are other examples. It's clear to me that there's a culture inside the NFL that tells these men that it's okay to treat women in degrading and misogynistic ways. And so I'm wondering, what can the NFL do to change that culture? Miren?
I mean, first of all, if you know, looking at the text messages, agree with you 100%, horrible. And if these allegations are true, absolutely horrible. But I think in order to change anything, you have to acknowledge that there's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's the NFL's first misstep. They don't acknowledge that this is systemic. This isn't an isolated case over here, isolated case over there. This has been going on for so long, and nothing's really changing. I also wish that, you know, the culture could change in the sense of social media amplifying these things. All I saw on Twitter was, why did she come out at this point? And, you know, the timing is suspect. I really wish people would inform themselves about sexual assault victims and how trauma can affect when you report, how you report, if you report at all.
The NFL takes a very measured approach, which I think you have to do with these things. But generally speaking, from where I sit, and as someone who hasn't watched the NFL in several years because of the issues I take with it, I think that it's very much we aren't going to punish anything until we actually see it. And by see it, I mean like Ray Rice, where there's actually video evidence of it, which is concerning because there's all sorts of stuff that happens that isn't seen. I think that's what a lot of people take issue with.
Yeah. So I've interviewed Brenda Tracy. She's a gang rape survivor who talks to athletes, mostly men, about putting an end to sexual assault. And she talks about the need for men to be allies in this fight. But when Tom Brady was asked about Antonio Brown on Wednesday, he said, quote, things that don't involve me don't involve me. And I like Tom Brady. I think he's a good man, and I can't help but wonder how different the world would be if he had instead said, I don't know if Brown raped his former trainer, but I do know that I never want my daughter to receive text messages like the ones he allegedly sent. Miren, you're up.
Yeah, this week I wrote a story for Bleacher Report's BR Mag on women's soccer and brain trauma. I went to Boston to visit Dr. Anne McKee, who, you know, her research has been integral to our understanding of CTE. So in the brain bank, only 5% of the brains are women's brains. But we know that women suffer repetitive hits, too. Girls, in fact, are just as likely to suffer concussions than boys football players and three times as likely to suffer them as soccer players. Women are now just getting to the ages of, you know, 40, 45, 50, where they might see the effects of these hits. Mm-hmm. And so what do you tell the younger generation who are playing more than ever, but we actually have no idea what's happening to their brains every time there's a collision, there's a header, there's an impact?
Obviously, you want more studies and more research to be done on women. But one of the challenging things with CTE is that the most critical research is stuff that you can't get until people die. It's not research that's going to come quickly. You have to convince people to even be willing to give themselves to science once they do actually pass away. As we talk about the pay gap disparity, I think you might have an even wider chasm for just the health and the research disparity for a sport that, you know, a lot of people would not have thought of as being nearly as physical or as violent, if you really want to call it that.
It is amazing to me how many people are still surprised when we say women get more concussions than men. I tried to look up the first time I reported on it, and it's so long ago, like, I can't find it in my archives, you know? But not all sports fans get their sports news from NPR. But here's the main question I had from reading your reporting, Miren. Dr. McKee has her own lab. Why doesn't she tackle this research?
I think it's extraordinarily difficult for a lot of the reasons that Chris was outlining, is that in order to study it, you have to receive brains. And the brain donation for her on women is just, it's such a struggle. Mm-hmm. It's hard, too, because McKee, her science is not even very much believed by people when she's talking about men, about mm-hmm. football. And so it's hard enough to push that uphill. I think the hardest part, too, is when you were talking about, you know, people were surprised. I think it's upsetting to learn about this. I think it's upsetting to think that, oh, okay, my girl can play soccer and this could hurt her later in life. We know that sports are so good for women's self-esteem and confidence. And it's very hard to kind of come to terms with, like, maybe this isn't the best thing.
Yeah, and I wonder how much for the athletes themselves, because I know I am very sensitive to being told, like, as a woman, you should not do whatever, you know, like, yes. It has a different context when it's placed in gender.
It does. And it's hard because this was such a great year for women. When, you know, we were watching the Women's World Cup, it was incredible. It was inspiring. And it's hard. But we have to remember that Megan Rapinoe, Abby Wambach, Michelle Akers, Brianna Scurry, these women pledged their brains. They're saying, study us. And although they didn't talk for my story, this is something they very much care about.
Yeah. All right, Chris, you're up.
So I came across a story looking at women's football in Utah. A woman named Kelsey McKinney wrote a story for Deadspin about the only all-girls football, tackle football, for basically, I think, 4th grade to 12th grade, and the challenges that they face in trying to not really get it off the ground, because in her reporting she found that it's basically exploded in terms of participation by about 900%, but basically trying to get it to being something that is kind of recognized through different high schools and making it a Title IX argument, which generally is something talked about at the college level as opposed to the high school level. So I found the story to be interesting. You absolutely have injury concerns, but also that in a way, playing in a league with other girls might keep them safer.
I remember being in elementary school and wanting to join the basketball team, and there was no girls' basketball team.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
So, like, what was I going to do? So I definitely joined the boys' team, and that's when I learned what Title IX was in fifth grade. And obviously, you don't really understand it. You just want to play. Yes, there are injuries, and both of these things are true. We shouldn't, like, not provide opportunity because perhaps there could be injuries. At least there should be opportunity. And at the very core of this story, you could kind of see how much it meant to these girls, and I think that's very important.
Football's a dangerous game. It is. And I'm supportive of finding all of the ways that can make it safer. And this league in Utah is exploring some of those. But there's no sport that has a bigger place in American culture than football does, especially at the high school level. And I just don't think we should be telling our girls that they can be prom queen, but they can't be captain of the football team.
I was really taken by one particular anecdote here about a girl who had gotten her hair done, and that she could embrace that, and that her teammates were running up to her, kind of giving her compliments on her hair. You should be able to have that. And it's funny, you know, the way that you all wanted to be involved. In my case, I wanted to play football as a kid, and my mom would not let me. And I'm grateful for it now, because I think there are all sorts of health concerns, as we talked about. But at the same time, I would not want there to be something in place that just bars me from being able to play. And as a guy, I can't even really relate to that.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Bleacher Report's Miren Fader and 538's Chris Herring. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me again.
This Wednesday marked 18 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks. Former pro ball player Pete Murphy, a New York native and Columbia University graduate, was in the North Tower of the World Trade Center, and 9/11 changed his relationship with the city forever. Only a Game's Alex Schroeder has the story.
Pete Murphy grew up in the New York City borough of Queens. By the age of two, he was swinging a baseball bat, his father would always say. Pete played baseball and football at his high school in Flushing, and at college, just across the East River at Columbia University in Manhattan. Pete emerged as a pitcher with enough talent to make the pros, though he says he never expected to be drafted. In the spring of 1986, he took the mound for the last start of his college career, a game against Harvard.
And then when I was warming up before the game, the coach came out to me and he said, Pete, you know, we really need this one. We had lost the game before, and I think we split the day before. So in order to make the playoffs, we really needed to have a win. And so nothing like a little added pressure before going out there on the mound.
Pete delivered, tossing a two-hit shutout with 11 strikeouts. A scout for the Pittsburgh Pirates was there, and he took notice. But Pete didn't know that. He graduated and started work at a law firm. The Pirates had other plans.
I got a call from my brother who said, well, the Pirates just called the house and said just they drafted you in the 23rd round. So I proceeded to walk into my boss, said, been nice working here for the 2 or 3 weeks, whatever it was, but I got to go.
The Pirates sent Pete to Florida as a member of the single A Bradenton Marauders. After Bradenton, it was back to New York, upstate, for parts of the 1986 and 1987 seasons with the Watertown Pirates. Pete also played minor league ball in Macon, Georgia and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, climbing the ranks to double A. Pete says he loved getting to know each of the cities along his journey through the minors. Still, those places weren't New York. What did you miss most about New York? Was it the pizza? You know, what?
Yeah. Well, that was the biggest adjustment. In the other towns, if it was 10 p.m., you were struggling to find someplace. I remember there was one time after a game. It went extra innings. We were all in the hotel. We were just south of D.C. And we were just in a hotel off of 95 down there. And there was nothing around. It's not like we could even go and walk somewhere. I ended up having to bribe the one pizza place that was open in order for them to bring pizzas to it. I bribed the guy like $20 or something. And then the kicker of it, the pizza ended up making us all sick.
At the end of every season, Pete would drive himself back home to New York.
The best part was always coming up the Jersey Turnpike, and when you can, you know, see the Twin Towers. And, you know, I knew I was home when I could start seeing the skyline of New York.
In 1991, Pete was stuck in AA with little hope of breaking through. He gave up his major league aspirations. He moved back to New York City and put his computer science degree to use. In 1995, he got a job in application development for the investment banking firm Lehman Brothers. In January 2001, the company moved some of its employees into offices in the World Trade Center's North Tower. Pete was excited to work in a building his father had helped construct.
We had the 38th, 39th, and 40th floors. I was on the kind of the eastern-facing side, so I was overlooking the plaza and looking out towards Queens, so I'd always feel like I was overlooking home when I was looking out that way.
On the morning of 9/11, Pete was at work early, preparing for meetings across the street in the company's headquarters. His boss went down from the 38th floor for a cigarette. Pete prepared to follow.
Gathered my stuff, I guess it was just about 8:40-ish, and went to get on the elevator.
Then Pete remembered he'd left something at his desk.
So I walked back to my desk. And just as I got to my desk, that's when the first plane hit.
From inside the building, Pete says it sounded like a loud bang.
The building moved so much that I actually stumbled and I had to grab onto the cubicle wall. I remember saying to myself, holy cow, this is going to be a long ride down, because it literally felt like the building was going to topple over.
Pete didn't know exactly what had happened, but he knew he needed to move. He made it to the stairway, which was already filled with people.
Everybody's kind of talking about, you know, what was that? What was that? And eventually we started getting reports on the pagers that the towers was hit by a Cessna. And you know, everybody, when they saw that, they're like, there is no way that was a Cessna that hit this building.
The scene got more tense. At times, the line down the stairs stopped moving. People started yelling.
People from the upper floors started coming down, like the injured people. And all of us, we ended up making a single file and kept the leftmost lane open for the people coming down. They were, you know, injured and bloody, and you know, your imagination starts going off. Well, it must be just kind of like hell on earth up there.
People were panicked, but at this point, Pete says, no one knew the tower was on the verge of collapse. He didn't even know the other tower had been hit. Firemen arrived, climbing up, and so Pete decided to seek an alternative, less crowded route. He found an emptier stairway. By the time Pete reached the ground floor, he'd heard that this was an act of terrorism. The lobby was almost unrecognizable from the damage. Pete and the others were sent out via the mall underneath the World Trade Center.
Because they didn't want anybody walking across the plaza, because at that time the jumpers from up top had started also.
Pete eventually emerged from behind Trinity Church, several blocks away.
That was kind of the first exposure I had to really the scale of what was going on. There was blood all over the street. I stopped, took a second, and looked up at the buildings, and that's when I saw the smoke pouring out of the buildings, and just thinking, this is not good, not good at all.
Pete needed to find a way out of Manhattan, and he needed to let his family know he was okay. He found a working payphone and left a message on his home answering machine. But his wife Mary was at her parents' house, following the news on TV.
And, you know, she's hearing all the 911 calls, and they're telling people to stay in the building and not to leave. And she actually checked our answering machine at home. And as she was listening to me on the answering machine, she was watching the building come down on TV. And she was kind of set in her mind at that point that I wasn't around anymore.
Pete spent 2 hours trying unsuccessfully to get out of Manhattan. Eventually, he made his way to the Midtown Tunnel, hitched a ride, and learned from the driver that the building he was working in just hours earlier was no longer there. When Pete made it back across the East River and home to Queens, he stopped to look at the spot where the towers had stood.
I still had kind of the shadow of the Twin Towers being there, like in my eyes, they were still there. And the smoke was coming up kind of through the shadow of the Twin Towers.
What was that moment like when you finally reconnected and reunited with your family?
It was, we were kind of very numb. She was kind of adjusting to me not being around anymore. So she was kind of just pinching me a bit and just like, you know, we hugged, and our lives have not been the same since.
I asked Pete Murphy if he ever thought about what might have happened if he hadn't left baseball and ended up at Lehman Brothers. If he had made it to the major leagues, maybe he wouldn't have been in the North Tower on the morning of 9/11.
There's all those forks in the road that you come to in your life. And, you know, I think everything worked out the way it was supposed to. You know, I got to live the dream for 6 years. It didn't end up the way I had hoped, but I like to think that I'm where I'm supposed to be right now with who I'm supposed to be with. And I really wouldn't, I honestly really don't think if I had the choice that I would change it.
That story came to us from Only a Game's Alex Schroeder. We first learned about Pete Murphy in a piece by writer Steve Cook on his website about minor league baseball, The Greatest 21 Days. Candace Miller writes romance novels. She also loves sports. And she says the two have more in common than you might think.
I say they follow the same beats. I want the Dodgers in the World Series against the Yankees in seven, and I want the Dodgers to win. That's my happily ever after right there.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, a cave diver goes inside an iceberg for science and sport. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
On Monday, the California State Assembly passed SB 206, a bill that would make it illegal for schools in California to punish student athletes for profiting off their own names and likenesses. And it therefore would pretty much destroy the entire NCAA amateurism structure. Am I overstating things?
No, you're being realistic, and so is the California legislature. There is absolutely no compelling logical, ethical, or any other kind of reason why a college athlete can't profit from his own image. That's crazy. And it's always been crazy. The testimony at the O'Bannon trial proved that it was crazy. And it was about time for some state or another to do this.
Well, the NCAA is basically saying, give us time to, quote, modernize our approach on this issue. The state senator who first introduced the bill has countered, saying that the NCAA has been stalling for decades. But still, it does seem like the NCAA holds a lot of cards here, because if the bill becomes law, California schools could be banned from national competition, right?
The NCAA could try to do that. It would be facing a staggering array of lawsuits, and it would also be, you know, shooting itself in the foot. And the legislator is absolutely right. The NCAA's tactic on this is to stall it as long as possible. And I've been saying for years, the NCAA mindset on this thing has got to change, because otherwise the whole thing is going to collapse at once and nobody's going to know what to do.
The United States flamed out of the FIBA World Cup with its worst finish in a major international basketball tournament. After about three dozen of this country's top players declined to make the trip to China, we really can't be surprised by this, can we?
Probably be a little bit surprised. I mean, they certainly shouldn't have lost as badly as they did. I think the players that made it deserve credit for going. I don't know how important the FIBA World Championship really is in terms of judging the status of American basketball.
Well, USA Basketball Managing Director Jerry Colangelo said, quote, "You can't help but notice and remember who you thought you were going to war with and who didn't show up." It seems to me that if noticing and remembering means not inviting back, Team USA is going to be mighty thin for next summer's Olympics in Tokyo, don't you think?
Yeah, Colangelo's just blowing off steam. I mean, he's a smart guy. He must recognize the contradiction inherent in what he said, that the way to solve the problem of not having our best players there is to insult our best players. You know, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
No. The Miami Dolphins lost their season opener to the Baltimore Ravens 59-10. And if that wasn't bad enough, according to Pro Football Talk's Mike Florio, quote, "multiple Dolphins players contacted their agents and directed them to attempt to engineer trades elsewhere." Apparently, the players think the team is tanking. Is tanking even a thing in the NFL?
We're going to see, because if this isn't tanking, it's the closest thing the NFL has ever come to it. And I don't blame the players. I mean, they're playing a dangerous sport for a team that doesn't necessarily want to win very often. They're in the number one draft pick business right now.
On Wednesday, Jonathan Villar hit a seventh-inning three-run home run to put the Baltimore Orioles up 5-2 over the Dodgers. And that baseball is going into the Hall of Fame, because that baseball was the 6,106th hit for a home run in MLB this season. And that's a lot, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's ever since they've replaced the baseball with, you know, flubber, you know, records are going to fall. I mean, clearly they juice the baseball, because they believe, as they, you know, that not merely chicks, but everybody digs the long ball.
Well, I know I'm going to expose myself as not a baseball purist here, but baseball is struggling to attract younger fans. It has a reputation for being boring. Why not encourage baseballs to fly out of ballparks?
I don't have a real problem with it. You know, essentially, a juiced baseball is what saved baseball after the Black Sox scandal and gave us Babe Ruth, for that matter. I mean, there are purists who don't like it, but you know what? There is nothing more tiresome in the world than a baseball purist.
And finally, Charlie, former snooker world champion Sean Murphy revealed this week that he was forced to miss a recent tournament because of an injury that proves that being a good dad is dangerous work. How was Murphy injured?
So Murph's at home and having Sunday dinner, and he's got a three-year-old son named Harry, and they slapped on the Disney's Greatest Hits.
As one does.
As one does, actually, with a three-year-old named Harry, or named anything else for that matter. And they were dancing around, and he partially tore his Achilles tendon dancing to the Disney hits. Now, I mean, if you watch people who play snooker, you realize that you sort of have to stand to play. And this is a real problem for your basic professional snooker person.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the forthcoming Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
A while back, and to be perfectly honest, this was a little more than 3 years ago, we received the following story pitch from a listener.
Hi, Only a Game. My name is Candace Miller. I am a listener from Los Angeles, California. I love your show.
Candace Miller publishes romance novels, and as Candace explained in her voice memo, the romance novel genre is a huge segment of the publishing industry.
It's largely credited with helping the publishing industry survive. It's so popular. At a conference I was at just a week or two ago, Nielsen said that more than 286 million units of romance novels were sold in 2015.
And that brings us to her pitch.
Sports is a huge, huge, huge subgenre within the realm of romance novels. If you think romance novels, you think Fabio or the woman in the Edwardian costume or what have you. Sports is really big.
Candace and I stayed in touch, and in November of 2016, she sent me an email to let me know that her publishing company's latest sports-based romance novel, Luchador, had been named one of Publishers Weekly's best books of 2016. Luchador is a gay romance set in Mexico's pro wrestling league, Lucha Libre. But it wasn't until a couple of weeks ago that Candace and I actually got a chance to sit down and talk about it. I do realize that it has been 3 years since you emailed your story idea to us, so you might not remember, but what inspired you to contact Only a Game about this phenomenon?
I was watching Bull Durham one night, as one is prone to do every time you see it pop up on television. It's just one of those, if I see it, I stay, I watch.
I believe in the Church of Baseball. I've tried all the major religions and most of the minor ones.
I got thinking about how sports movies and romance novels are so much alike. And in fact, a lot of films that people perceive as being sports films are actually romance.
Well, so let's talk about Bull Durham, because we have to.
My favorite movie, which I just rewatched.
It's so good. So what is it about this movie that makes it appeal to people who like sports and people who like romance?
Well, first of all, it may be the best baseball movie ever. I realize that's arguable. Yeah. There are some good ones out there. The Natural, love that. Field of Dreams, love that. But I would argue Bull Durham is just this great, great, it's not only a baseball film, but at the heart of that film, it's a romantic comedy. It's a romance. It's about Crash Davis and Annie Savoy, who are two incredibly well-written characters.
And of course, it has one of the best speeches ever by Crash Davis.
Ever. Ever.
I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing AstroTurf and the designated hitter. I believe in the sweet spot, softcore pornography, opening your presents Christmas morning rather than Christmas Eve, and I believe in long, slow, deep, soft, wet kisses that last 3 days.
And Annie Savoy, I would argue, is the heart and soul of that movie. She's an intelligent woman. She's a quirky woman. She knows baseball inside and out. There is a sense of empowerment in Annie Savoy. There's also fragility. She is very representative of modern romance novels.
Who dresses you?
What?
Who dresses you? I mean, do you think this is a little excessive for the Carolina League?
The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake.
What, William Blake?
William Blake!
What do you mean, William Blake?
I mean, William Blake!
It follows the tropes and storylines and beats of a classic romance novel.
And tropes isn't a bad word in romance fiction?
Oh, no. Tropes are wonderful in romance. They are deeply embraced. And very often, if you're on Twitter, you'll see someone cast a little net out saying, what's your favorite trope? And everyone will respond, I love there was only one bed. You know, these are all tropes that people play with.
So in sports, a trope would be the underdog wins.
Right. Good example.
And people love that.
Yes, in sports and in romance. I say they follow the same beats. I want the Dodgers in the World Series against the Yankees in 7, and I want the Dodgers to win. That's my happily ever after right there.
And you don't want it to come too easy, right? You don't want them to win all season long and sweep the series. I mean, that's...
Well, I do want them to win all season long. But I want them to earn it. And you have to earn it in a romance novel, too.
We're going to get a little bit meta here with a book that's not even out yet, but I think it's an example that tells us something about why sports romance novels are popular. Tell me about the Bromance Book Club.
I absolutely adored the Bromance Book Club. It's the story of a professional baseball player who suddenly finds that his marriage is not working out and his wife wants to leave him. His buddies with the team pull him aside and say, you know, come with us. And they introduce him to their book club. Their book club has sort of the Fight Club mentality in that the first rule of book club is you don't talk about book club. Because they read romance novels and they have all fixed their marriages by reading and learning from romance novels.
So I asked a couple of my colleagues to perform a short excerpt.
Romance novels are primarily written by women for women. And they're entirely about how they want to be treated and what they want out of life and in a relationship. We read them to be more comfortable expressing ourselves and to look at things from their perspective.
You guys are serious.
Dead serious.
Is that how you would define a romance novel?
Yes. It's not every romance novel, but certainly that is an overarching theme. Modern romance very often is about female empowerment, about standing up for what you want and going out and getting it without apology, and that includes in your romantic life. You know, right now, what's hot in romance novels are hockey novels.
Really?
Yes. Check Please started out as a web-based comic. It's about a college hockey team and focuses on one character in particular who had started out as a figure skater but wanted to go to a particular college. So he tried out for the hockey team, closeted gay kid. Ultimately, as the story builds, and it's been around for a few years now, it's coming to a conclusion soon, it ends up that the story is not only a story of sort of the bromance of this hockey team, but a romance between a star hockey player and this kid.
Your mom just texted me asking what food I like for the holidays?
Oh my God, my boyfriend is meeting my parents.
And that sort of brings us to an interesting facet of this, is that homosexuality is still not accepted widely in men's sports, but that doesn't seem to be true of romance novels.
Not in the slightest. Queer romance novels and sports novels, there's a strong intersection there. Let's face it, the large majority of readers of romance are women, but not exclusively. But yes, women read gay romances. It's extremely popular, and also lesbian fiction with sports. I tell you, the upcoming trend in romance novels, the inspiration is going to be the women's U.S. soccer team. In about a year, you're going to see a bunch of soccer romances.
With heroines with pink hair, maybe?
Yes, more than likely.
We haven't really talked about Luchador, so tell me about it.
Well, Luchador, and for all transparency, that's me under a pen name. But Luchador is, you know, that was an interesting book to write because I've always been a little bit of a fan of Lucha Libre, but I always kind of viewed it as this kitschy, fun, goofy thing because growing up here in the Los Angeles area, there's a thing called Lucha Vavoom, and you go to that, and it's like lucha mixed with burlesque, mixed with a whole lot of booze. And it's a great time. It's a great time. And that's always how I viewed Lucha Libre. And then I was listening to Weekend Edition on NPR, and they did a story about exóticos. And exóticos are essentially, they're by and large, but not always, gay men wrestling in drag. And you think about that and the sort of innate narrative conflict in that, that here's this very macho environment of lucha libre and wrestling, and openly embracing gay competitors, but to compete openly like that, they also have to be essentially in drag. And I thought that was fascinating. And I dove deep into it. I went down to Mexico City and I got to know some of the wrestlers and I went to a whole lot of lucha and just I just fell in love with it and ultimately wrote a coming of age slash romance set in the world of lucha libre. And that's Luchador.
Jason reached for Gabriel's hand. Gabriel turned and shot him a warning look. It was one thing to be a comfortably out couple in the arts district. It was another at an Extrema match in Pico Rivera. So are the women who read sports romance novels typically sports fans?
Not always. I mean, yes, some of us are diehard sports fans. I'm a hockey fan, and I see this particularly in book Twitter all the time. People have been drawn to the game and becoming hockey fans by reading romances. People who are now avidly following not only the NHL, but the AHL and college hockey because they've read these books. It's great.
I love it. So I suspect that there are probably one or two or, you know, half a million Only a Game listeners at home who are still shaking their heads and wondering if a romance novel set in sports can really be satisfying. Would you like to take one more crack at convincing them?
Yeah, why not? I would advise someone, find a book that's a sport that maybe you don't follow. Read that and see if it doesn't draw you in and make you more interested in that sport. I know, knowing so many of these authors, when they get it right, they really get it right. Some of them write like great sports writers. They just happen to have a little love in there, too.
That's Candace Miller. She's the co-owner of Interlude Press, and her novel, written under the pen name Aaron Finnegan, is called Luchador. Many thanks to my colleagues Marquise Neal, Kyrie Thompson, Josh Swartz, Paul Kahlo, and Taylor Pendleton Harris for lending their voices to our romance novel excerpts. And if you have a story idea for us, email it to oag@wbur.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Kyrie Thompson. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.